also responsible for committing a war crime. So I think all these factors are there, but we need even more pressure. And I really salute all the American honest and noble people, including the American Jewish people, who are demonstrating against this terrible genocide and preserving the human values of humanity and pressuring Biden. They should continue this pressure because Netanyahu did not give up and he is still trying to maneuver. He will try to make the negotiations in Cairo fail and use that as a justification for a new attack on Rafah. We know they are preparing for a new attack in Rafah. We know that Netanyahu even tries to escalate in the north and have a military confrontation with Iran and with Lebanon if he can. And that explains why he went and attacked a consulate, a diplomatic consulate of Iran, violating every norm of international law. So in reality, we are facing here a group of aggressors who would like to continue this war and even expand it, who are very angry at their failure. And by the way, I think part of the American administration anger at Netanyahu is that they really gave him so much time, 6 months beyond any expectations, and he still failed to fulfill his military goals and failed to achieve what he promised he would do.
I want to bring Mohammed Shahada into this conversation, writer and analyst, communications chief at Euro-Mediterranean, Human Rights Monitor. Double the explosive power of the bombs used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki have been used on Gaza. I wanted to ask what these 6 months have meant for your family and friends in Gaza. You are from there. And about a report that you all put out, a report that Euromed Monitor put out about killing starving Palestinians, targeting aid trucks, etc.
Well, basically, by now, every single person I know in Gaza was exposed to the scene of decomposing bodies. And virtually everyone I know heard the noises of their neighbors, friends, down from underneath the rubble, and they couldn't do anything about it. It's even too dangerous to try to rescue people. And everybody I know, at least almost everyone in my family, had their homes bombed. It expands to my circle of friends. At my work with Euromed Monitor, we lost at least 5 team members. One of our team members found his mother executed at Al Shifa Hospital. He saw her decomposing bodies lying there on the ground. And it's not just the mass killing that is the problem. It's the deliberate, intentional targeting of civilians, the complete disregard for human life that we're seeing on full display, and the cruelty of the killing itself. We see bodies flattened by Israeli tanks, literally turned into mush, crushed by Israeli tanks and armored vehicles. We see people hacked into pieces by Israeli missiles and shells. And we see people having their arms bound, their eyes blindfolded, and then executed, especially at Al-Shifa Hospital. So the nature, the cruelty of the killing is very striking in that sense, especially that it's very open. They're not even trying to hide it. And that it's incredibly underreported on. It doesn't make it to any mainstream media, basically. The other dimension that we see there is the amount of people, the hidden iceberg of about 70,000 to 80,000 people who have been maimed or burned severely or wounded critically without basically any appropriate medical treatment or the possibility to go out of Gaza and seek medical treatment. At the moment, it's only very, very meager, very minor numbers of people that are allowed outside Gaza to get medical treatment. And hospitals in Gaza, the majority of them have been fully compromised by Israel surgically, one after the other, in broad daylight, without any sort of condemnation from the U.S. or the European Union. We see also the mass destruction, as you alluded, twice the amount of bombs that were used in Hiroshima. There's an estimate that it's about 70,000 tons of bombs that were dropped on Gaza. And we recently see Israeli officials admitting in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz saying that we could have achieved the same military objectives with about 10% of the damage, but, quote, cruelty was the point. There's an attempt to make a message here. There's also the unethical, extremely insane use of artificial intelligence in targeting people. There's also the very bizarre notion that the Israeli soldiers or Israeli troops, commanders, they set up virtual, quote, extermination areas in Gaza. Any person that crosses that area or happens to be in that area is executed at the spot or detained and tortured at the Sidi Tayman Israeli military base, where thousands of Palestinians are being held at that black spot, away from any sort of legal purview, without being charged or put on trial. And they are subjected to daily torture in every sense of the word, in the most unimaginable ways possible. They're being electrocuted, burned with cigarettes, urinated upon, spat upon. They have their arms and legs tied at all times. They are forced to squat down and sit blindfolded, tied again arms and legs for weeks. If they are sleep deprived, if they try to sleep or speak to one another, they get beaten up by soldiers immediately. And we recently saw a report from Israeli doctors last week in Haaretz again. One dissenting doctor wrote a letter to Israeli ministers warning that we're all complicit in grave violations of the law, because Palestinian detainees, or even political hostages at this point, they are mass arrested as a bargaining chip, therefore political prisoners or hostages. They had, some of them are routinely, quote, having their legs amputated from wounds of being handcuffed, both arms and legs, for weeks and weeks and months. And then there is the last dimension of the engineered systematic starvation throughout Gaza, but most prominently and most severely in the north, where, as Dr. Mustafa said earlier, we have about 500,000 to 700,000 people stuck in the north of Gaza, refusing to leave. Israel is continuing a process of ethnic cleansing in the north up until now. They continue to drop leaflets on people, telling them to move south if they want food, if they want safety, although the south is just as ravaged and compromised and devastated as the north. And we see Israel not just preventing aid from going to the north, but targeting anybody, literally anybody, that tries to secure the aid trucks coming through, prevent looting, and ensure fair distribution. Around the time that Israel invaded Al-Shifa, in fact, one of the reasons why they invaded Al-Shifa is the civil government in Gaza was operating from there after virtually all government facilities around the north of Gaza were destroyed and razed. They had only Al-Shifa to operate from there because there was electricity and access to people, and they can organize from there an emergency committee that can be in charge of securing the delivery of aid and its fair distribution. It worked out on the 16th and 17th of March very well. That was the first time since the war started, in about 170 days at the time, that aid made it all the way to Jabalia and was distributed to people without any disruption, without any looting, without any chaos. The day after, on Monday, that's when Israel started invading Al-Shifa, and assassinated, targeted assassinations against key figures that were responsible for securing the aid. So we see this very deliberate, very engineered starvation process of people in northern Gaza to ethnically cleanse it and force them out, but also to sustain chaos in the entirety of the Gaza Strip, to sustain the loss of civil order, and to bring about a societal collapse in whole or in part, to push it to the deepest conscience of people in Gaza, to the deepest of their minds, the idea of leaving, that it should be their only ticket to survival, to achieve the Israeli goal of population transfer, what they refer to as thinning the population. They call it voluntary migration, but in fact it's ethnic cleansing. And we see that process still on full display. And we see a very systematic, deliberate conscience effort to make Gaza uninhabitable for decades to come.
Before we end, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, I wanted to ask you about one of the most prominent Palestinian prisoners who has been jailed. He's died from cancer in an Israeli prison. The novelist Waleed Daqa had spent the past 38 years locked up for his involvement with an armed group that abducted and killed an Israeli soldier in 1984. Rights groups had been pressuring Israel to release him, saying he was in dire need of medical attention. Last month, Amnesty International called for his release, saying that since October 7th, he'd been tortured, humiliated, and denied family visits. Can you tell us about Waleed Daqa and the effect of his death in prison?
Well, Waleed Daqa is the 14th prisoner who dies in jail in Israeli prisons since 7th of October. The 13 others were beaten to death. In this case, Waleed died because of cancer. But Waleed Daqa suffered from medical negligence for years, not only recently, but especially recently. Waleed Daqa finished his term, by the way. His ruling was that he would be in jail for 37 years, and that period finished, but they wouldn't release him. They kept him through new military orders, knowing that he's having cancer and that he needs urgent treatment and he needs to be with his family. But the most inhuman behavior was the fact that they did not allow his wife and his daughter, his only daughter, to visit him since the 7th of October. And while knowing that he was in terminal stage, just about to die, they refused to let them even come to his prison and say goodbye to him and see him for the last time. That kind of behavior is savage. And I think that's the nature of the treatment. And to add insult to injury, Ben-Gvir, this fascist minister of interior security who is in charge of prisons, Israeli prisons, declared that he is sorry that Waleed Daqa, this famous novelist and writer, and who especially wrote for children, he said that Ben-Gvir said he was sorry that Waleed Daqa died because of cancer and was not executed by the Israeli military. This is the kind of mentality we have to deal with. And by the way, I mean, while we are talking, I have to really mention, I've just been recently able to visit some of the injured people from Gaza who are being treated in other countries. And these are not just numbers. When we say 75,000 people injured, there are 11,000 people in need to be treated outside because there is no treatment for them in Gaza, like the 10,000 cases of cancer. But the people who got out, I met some of them. One of them was a woman who lost her hand, lost her leg, lost her husband, lost her three children actually, and now she's left alone. Another one lost her sight. A third one is now paraplegic because she was hit in the back, and so on and so forth. It's a terrible situation. And you know what hurts me a lot? Is that when six white people from Poland, Australia, and Britain were killed by the same Israeli army, and of course we are absolutely shocked that they were killed while they were trying to provide humanitarian aid. But because these six people who are internationals and not Palestinians, the whole world was up in arms and the United States was criticizing Israel. But we didn't see the same reaction to the 40,000 Palestinians killed so far, including almost 15,000 children, and including, by the way, the seventh person from this international group who was a Palestinian. I think this kind of discrimination and racism is something we should all stand up against, because at the end of the day, what Palestinians want is very simple. We want freedom, we want self-determination, we want to be equal to everybody. We want to be treated as equal human beings. And it is the duty and responsibility of every person in this world who believes in humanity to be on the side of the Palestinian people. This is not a time to be neutral or to ignore this terrible genocide that is taking place against the population of Gaza.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, I want to thank you for being with us, physician and politician, General Secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative, and Muhammad Shahada, writer and analyst, communications chief at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, speaking to us from Copenhagen. Dr. Barghouti speaking to us from Ramallah. And I should add that Ben-Gvir, the cabinet minister, who is threatening to pull out of the government if Netanyahu doesn't have the Israeli troops invade Rafah, was himself convicted of inciting anti-Arab racism and hatred and supporting a terrorist group. Coming up, millions of people across the U.S. will be donning protective glasses today to witness the total solar eclipse. We'll speak with a NASA climate scientist about the phenomenon and about the climate catastrophe. Stay with us.
I can do a total eclipse of the heart. Once upon a time there was light in my life, but now there's only love in the dark. Nothing I can say, a total eclipse of the heart.
Of the Heart by Bonnie Tyler. Yes, people will be donning their glasses today to watch the solar eclipse across parts of the United States. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a moment, we're going to look at that. We're also going to look at the climate crisis, as scientists warn three of the most significant human-caused greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, reached new record highs again last year. That's according to U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, which said global carbon dioxide levels are now over 50% higher than they were before mass industrialization due to the burning of fossil fuels, deforestation, and livestock agriculture. New data has also confirmed that March was the hottest ever recorded and the 10th consecutive month to set a global heat record. Meanwhile, climate scientists continue to raise alarm about the catastrophic impacts of rising temperatures in Antarctica after researchers in 2022 recorded the largest hike in temperature ever measured in the coldest region on Earth. For more, we're joined by Peter Kalmus, climate activist and a climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, speaking on his own behalf, not on behalf of NASA. He's joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Dr. Kalmus. Before we go to the climate catastrophe, I want to talk to you about today's much-anticipated solar eclipse. Millions of people across North America donning protective glasses this afternoon to witness the eclipse when the moon covers all or a portion of the sun. Beginning in Mexico's Pacific coast, from there the path will continue into Texas and across dozens of other states before the eclipse enters Canada in southern Ontario. And here in New York, six prisoners in Sullivan County at the Woodburn Correctional Facility will be among those gathering outside to view the rare event after winning a lawsuit that argued forcing them to remain indoors was a violation of their religious beliefs. The prison had issued a lockdown during the time of the eclipse, which will peak in New York at 3:25. It's been, what, 7 years since the last total solar eclipse? Can you explain it to us?
Yeah, so I did have the good fortune to see the eclipse in 2017 in Oregon, and it was quite stunning, actually, quite amazing, something to see. So, I was trained as an astrophysicist. My training is in physics, and I was an astrophysicist before I was a climate scientist. And I'm going to take this back to kind of my understanding of global heating. This planet, we live on a planet. It's a sphere. It's going around the sun. There's the moon going around this planet. And every so often, it's going to go right in front of the sun, and we're going to have a shadow on the Earth, and that's all that's happening. It's exactly the same as any object blocking a light source and creating a shadow, except it reminds us that we are on a planet, and we are in the vast, vast cosmic space, right? The distances between planets and the sun are so huge that it's very infrequent that you get the moon lining up just so in front of the sun to create that shadow that completely blocks out the sun for a couple of minutes. We are on a very fragile place with a very fragile climate system that is very much able to be pushed by humans burning fossil fuels, for example, and that's what we're starting to see as things get hotter and hotter. So I think this is a good opportunity for people to reflect on the fact that we live on a very fragile and beautiful rock in space, the only place we know in the cosmos to support life.
And why is it important that we wear these glasses? As I put them on right now, and now people, there is a rush to get these. I can see nothing just sitting here in the studio through these kind of sunglasses. Explain what they do.
Yeah, well, they basically block a lot of the light from the sun so that you don't go blind and you don't hurt your eyes. So please don't look directly at the sun.
Mm. And what about pets? What about animals? What happens to them?
I mean, eyes work the same in humans as in animals. So don't, you know, I think most animals will have enough sense to not look directly at the sun.
Or to don these glasses. The New York Times had an interesting piece, The Eclipse That Ended a War and Shook the Gods Forever. Thales, a Greek philosopher, 2,600 years ago, is celebrated for predicting a famous solar eclipse and founding what came to be known science as science. Your final thoughts on this, Dr. Peter Kalmus?
I really want to talk about global heating and the climate crisis. So, I think, you know, science is, it seems strange to have to remind people of this, but science is just an incredibly, it's a treasure. It's a human treasure. And we're seeing so much anti-science right now, which breaks my heart. So many people are easily misled by disinformation, from the fossil fuel industry, from politicians. It breaks my heart that somebody, for example, who spreads lies and who is anti-science could actually be elected into public office and continue the damage. It's as a society, we're also very fragile. We live in a very fragile climate system, but we're very easily misled by disinformation. And science is essentially the antidote. Science is how we understand reality. And when we don't pay attention to what's really happening, for example, on planet Earth, it's incredibly dangerous. And right now we're in a situation, in my opinion, with global heating, where billions of lives are at risk.
So let's talk about global heating. The solar eclipse apparently brought down empires because people were so frightened by it. We'll see if climate activism takes on governments to change their positions. If you can talk about these firsts that we're experiencing, the last one I talked about in Antarctica, the hottest year on record we just passed there. What does all of this mean, Peter?
Right. So the fossil fuel industry is still expanding. They're controlled by very rich people who have all of the power. The power structures in this society, as you well know, are geared towards the very rich. They control a lot of the media. They spread disinformation. The public right now, because the planet's getting so hot, and as we've seen since March of 2023, as you mentioned, the last 10 months being the hottest on record, it looks to me like we are entering a sort of potentially new regime, a potential acceleration in global heating. The climate scientist community does not have a very good understanding on why things are going so off the charts over the last year or so. It's deeply disturbing to me. The fossil fuel industry is the cause, make no mistake. When that gets expanded, you release more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, more methane into the atmosphere, and that is going to make the planet get hotter. In 2021, six fossil fuel executives went in front of Congress. They were asked directly, is climate change, is global heating an urgent crisis? They said yes. They were asked directly, will you stop spreading disinformation? They would not agree to doing that, which is tantamount to them saying that they will continue spreading disinformation. I cannot think of anything more evil than for people, for these executives and lobbyists and their lawyers to be continuing to profit, to line their pockets at the irreversible habitability, like destruction of habitability of the Earth. I should probably mention who those CEOs were in 2021 who went before Congress. There were Darren Woods, the CEO of Exxon, Michael Wirth, the CEO of Chevron, David Lawler, the CEO of BP, Gretchen Watkins, the president of Shell, Mike Sommers, the president of the American Petroleum Institute, and Suzanne Clark, the CEO of the Chamber of Congress. So when they are able to kind of block action by essentially bribing politicians, when they control the mainstream media, right, when they buy advertisements in the New York Times and Reuters so that these trusted news sources will not connect the dots. These news sources will report on a heat wave, they'll report on a flood, they'll report on a wildfire, which is climate related, but they will not say that the cause is the fossil fuel industry, that the fossil fuel industry has been lying for decades, has essentially pledged to continue lying, that we're on a trend getting warmer and warmer every single year, getting hotter and hotter, which is why all of these records that are being broken should be absolutely no surprise to the public, right? If you're on an escalator towards hotter planetary temperatures, of course you're going to be breaking records over and over again. And again, I want to reiterate, the cause is the fossil fuel industry. The only way out of this heat nightmare is to end the fossil fuel industry. They will try to distract you as much as possible, talking about things like carbon capture, talking about things like nature-based solutions. It's all distraction. We have to end the fossil fuel industry. Until we do that, the planet will keep getting hotter. We'll see more deadly heat waves. We'll see them coming more frequently, more intense. We'll see more crop failures. We'll see more flooding. Eventually, we'll see mass amounts of climate refugees, geopolitical destabilization like we've never experienced before. And the public is still essentially asleep because the mainstream media is not reporting this with the urgency that it demands as an actual emergency.
I wanted to ask you about climate activist Greta Thunberg, who was detained twice by police at a protest at The Hague in the Netherlands. Before she was arrested, she addressed journalists. This is what she said.
We are here because we are facing an existential crisis. We are in a planetary emergency, and we are not going to stand by and let people lose their lives and livelihood and be forced to become climate refugees when we can do something.
So that's Greta Thunberg at The Hague. Peter, you also have been arrested protesting around climate change. And I wanted to end by asking about this Janet Yellen meeting in Beijing. It is said that one point of contention is China's production of green technologies like solar power, electric vehicles, and lithium batteries, Yellen refusing to rule out tariffs on Chinese green exports, despite Biden's declaring climate change an existential threat to the world. If you can weigh in on this.
You know, I remember a moment back when President Obama was elected to a second term. I wrote a letter to The New York Times saying this is a huge opportunity for the United States to take leadership on climate change and all the economic benefits, the jobs that will come from that. And instead, President Obama expanded the fossil fuel industry, and after his presidency, he bragged about expanding it. We should be looking for all sorts of ways to expand solar and wind and to end the fossil fuel industry. Those are two sides of the same coin. The harder side is actually ending fossil fuels. We should focus on that. But I don't care where solar, where wind comes from, where any of these solutions come from. We need all hands on deck right now. A lot more of us should be getting arrested.
We have to leave it there. Climate activist, climate scientist. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.